So, how do you describe the scale of an ongoing disaster? If you were reporting this week on the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, the first thing you would have to do is convey the scope of the event. And it's been a struggle because there are so many things to measure, starting with, but not limited to, size.
Here's an image of the spill taken from space.
Gushing 42,000 gallons of oil into the Gulf of Mexico every day, creating a slick about the size of Rhode Island.
Yeah. This slick is the size of Delaware. Aware. There's no other way to put it.
A growing blob of oil, now the size of Jamaica, menaces five coastal states.
Jackie Savitz, a senior scientist with Oceana, an international ocean conservation association, says that describing the scale of the leak in geographical terms, or how it looks from outer space, gives the public an incomplete understanding of the spill's true dimension.
It may paint a picture of an area on the surface of the ocean that's the size of Delaware, to the exclusion of all that area down below the surface, where lots of fish and other marine animals live who are also being exposed to the contamination. It might be more telling to think of it in terms of volume, like how many Olympic-sized pools is that, or how many stadiums would that be, or what lake might that be equivalent to?
Does the fact that we can see it from space actually convey anything meaningful?
Most people don't really have a sense of how far away space is, and even when you say it, I'm not really sure how far away you're talking about. Is it a satellite that's circling the Earth, or are you seeing it from the moon, right? There's a lot of space out there.
But one bit of media misdirection you think that's taking place is a focus on whether or not the oil spill will hit the coast.
Well, and I think the media means well in this case. But what it does is I think it leads people to think, okay, well, it's not a problem until it hits the coast. The truth is that there's a broad diversity of marine life that live in the area right where the spill is that have been exposed to toxic contaminants now for almost 2 weeks. Endangered species like sea turtles, marine mammals like bottlenose dolphins. So if we only think about what's going to happen when it hits the coast, we really haven't characterized the devastation that's happening in our ocean right now as we speak and continuing to happen.
And even preventing it from hitting the coast requires taking some risk with the environment, right? I mean, in order to make that slick small enough so that you couldn't see it from space, you'd have to drop toxic chemicals on it to get it off the surface.
Exactly. The use of chemicals that they call dispersants, they're breaking up the oil so that it dissolves into the water, so maybe it doesn't wash up on the coast. It's not going to create those ugly pictures of birds and globs of oil on the beach as often, but it doesn't mean that we've solved the problem or the problem's really gone away. It's still there. Really, whether it's a good idea or not depends on whether you're a seabird or a fish.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you, Brooke.
Jackie Savitz is a senior scientist with the conservation organization Oceana. Of course, there's yet another dimension of the spill to consider, the political one. What's the scale of that? How much of the blame for it falls at the feet of government? For commentators on the political right, Katrina is the ideal metric to apply to the government's response to the spill.
Most people would assume that the federal government didn't get involved because they thought BP was going to take care of it. But it's the same thing with Katrina. Bush said he didn't get involved because he's waiting for Louisiana to call him in.
That's a perfect analogy.
Look, this is unconscionable that they had a plan in place. They would burn off the oil in an instant like this. The administration didn't do it. Criticism coming from the Sierra Club that Obama's response to the oil spill was worse than Katrina.
That damn oil slick. Obama's Katrina.
Hurricane reporter Mark Schlefstein covered Katrina for the New Orleans Times-Picayune. Seen from the Louisiana perspective, he says, there's not much of a comparison.
This is Katrina light at best. What happened during Katrina was that the disaster had known consequences. In fact, Bush was shown a video presentation by the director of the National Hurricane Center that showed that the entire city of New Orleans would be flooded if the thing went in as a Category 5. But despite that information in advance of Hurricane Katrina, there were not significant efforts made to assure that people would be able to be rescued immediately. The difference here is that this is a much slower kind of a disaster event, and the result of that was that there actually was time to deal with things as they moved along. I really don't understand how people could say the administration did not immediately respond to this incident. I still don't see that there's a real way of comparing the two. They're just not the same.
The only comparison that you see is that in both cases, there was a failure by authorities to anticipate and prepare for a potential disaster.
Right. And the problem here is that they had the lesson learned from Katrina. For instance, the Army Corps of Engineers is building its risk lessons from Katrina into everything that it now does as an agency. It was expected that those same risk lessons would be delivered to other agencies of the federal government. Obviously, in this case, they were not delivered to the Minerals Management Service. They did not really take seriously the potential for a catastrophic event occurring that far offshore.
So if I could ask you to function as a media critic here for a moment rather than as a reporter, what do you think the motive is then behind pundits and news organizations using phrases like Obama's Katrina?
Well, it's easy to say that. I think it's very clear that saying Obama's Katrina is certainly a marketing tool that works very well. I just don't think it works in this particular instance.
Mark, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mark Schlefstein is a reporter for the New Orleans Times-Picayune. And finally, reporters have to summon up language to convey the environmental impact. But how do you describe the scope of something that is still unknown? Some reporters opt for prose that matches the color of the spill. Purple.
Meanwhile, Gulf communities are racing for an economic and environmental catastrophe.
The devastation is already occurring.
I expect this will be the biggest oil spill in the world by far.
The leak takes months to plug. As some have predicted, this could be the worst environmental disaster in our nation's history.
And given the rarity of such enormous spills, reporters reach back to a past calamity as a reference and a reminder of an accident that burned the image of rainbow-slicked shorelines and slimed seabirds into America's consciousness, the Exxon Valdez disaster of 1989.
It could be worse than the Valdez 20 years ago unless they can figure out how to stop this leakage.
It threatens to eclipse the devastation caused by the Exxon Valdez.
This BP spill, if it keeps up at the current rate in 50 days, it will be worse than the Exxon Valdez.
Charles Woolforth covered the Exxon Valdez spill in 1989. He says that both the purple prose and the Valdez comparisons are too much, too soon.
I think that the media kind of got a little ahead of itself. I saw stories that were saying it would be worse than the Exxon Valdez and calling it a catastrophe pretty early on. And the fact is, we really don't know how bad it is yet. And one really dramatic difference between this spill and the Exxon Valdez is that in the Exxon Valdez, you had over 11 million gallons dumped in 6 hours, just a few miles from shore. In this case, you have something around 200,000 gallons a day being dumped 50 miles away from shore. So in the Exxon Valdez, you had an enormous amount of oil that was, within 3 days, completely coasting a inland sea, essentially. And here you have oil that's pretty far offshore and it gets significantly degraded before it gets to shore. And it doesn't sound like, at least as we're talking today, we know it's bad, but it's just nowhere near on the scale of Exxon Valdez yet.
Woolforth says that reporters covering Valdez back in 89 did a pretty good job, given the obstacles posed by so unusual a story in so inaccessible a place.
So they were kind of at a loss in how to get out there, how to see it, how to evaluate what they're looking at. And they were covering a story that most of them had never covered before, because major oil spills don't happen that often. So there was a certain amount of exaggeration or erroneous coverage. But overall, they got it right. I mean, if you measure it by the impression that the public got, it was a huge environmental disaster, off the charts, really. And people got that word, and they understood it, and they appreciated, at least briefly, the fact that once you have an oil spill of this size, that there's really not that much you can do about it and that the devastation is horrendous.
In terms of impact, the media did its job, in your view. And in this case, do you think that the headline-grabbing nature of this coverage is doing the same job?
Well, one of the fears I have about the coverage is that if we dodge the bullet and if they are able to shut off the oil and the disaster isn't nearly as bad as Exxon Valdez, then it's kind of a cry wolf situation. It's, oh, look at those environmentalists exaggerating everything again. You can't trust them. So there's a real cost to saying it's a catastrophe before it is a catastrophe. even if it has very negative impacts that are very serious, if they're not as bad as you said they were going to be, then people kind of tend to discount them, whereas if they were encountering them without having that expectation, they might take them much more seriously. So I think it's important to be really careful about what has actually happened and what might happen, because it does have a huge political impact on how we're going to deal with the environmental issues in the future.
Charles, thank you very much.
Sure.
Charles Woolforth writes on the environment. His book, The Fate of Nature, comes out in June. The fate of the region in the wake of the spill is unknown. All of us hate unknowns. But with the future as murky as the Gulf of Mexico, any commentator who claims to offer clarity right now is only muddying the waters.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.